And we're back. Episode 190 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Greg, what's going on, man?
Not much. Fun little weekend of weightlifting competition and what have you. And now it's back to the real world.
Nice. Nice.
The real world where weightlifting doesn't accomplish anything for you.
Other than pain and misery and cost and all that.
Yes. Just nice. Kidding. It was awesome. The team did really well. We had we had a couple people who needed to qualify for either national championships or Americans, and everyone who needed to do that did it. And then we had a couple people who were trying to qualify for the A session at nationals, and they all did that. So
right on.
All in all, a very successful day.
Very, very cool. I accomplished significantly less over the weekend, but that's just the way it goes. So it's a rainy and blustery and cold in Reno. Like, where's my freaking summer? Greg and I were just talking about this. So who knows? Yeah, maybe Florida. We may be moving to the Florida Keys here soon. I'm over this shit. I'm tired I'll take a once a year hurricane and have 5 days of, you know, 200 mile an hour winds over cold and rain and overcast. So
I prefer the like one earthquake every 10 to 15 years sort of thing.
That's true. So what else is going on? What's new? What's exciting? What do people need to know?
Let's see. What do they need to know? They need to know that our weightlifting coach certification thing is fully functional, up and running.
Nice.
You can go check out catalyst.com/cert to get all the info there. Along with that, of course, we have our affiliation program now. So if you are a Catalyst Athletics certified weightlifting coach or are soon to become one, you can apply to affiliate. And if you meet certain criteria, we would love to have you on board.
Wait, you have standards?
We do have standards.
That's crazy talk.
I know. I know. Restricted entry. It's bizarre. But we do actually value the name and reputation of Catalyst Athletics and would like to feel good about the people we refer other people to.
Yeah. Speaking of restricted entry, when we write our book at some point, that'll be very interesting to explore the complete non-restricted entry that many have experienced in the fitness scene, but that's an entirely different
story. They let
me
in for a while.
I'm not even talking about that, but
yes.
Yes. Okay, our show sponsors. Why don't we jump in? Why don't we go from that to
You know what? We just start with the Bunny Ranch after that one.
Let's just go right to the Bunny Ranch since that really is the more appropriate segue. BunnyRanch.com. Check it out. Clearly, it's porn. It's naked people. Don't check it out at work or at home if that's going to get you in trouble. But definitely check out the Bunny Ranch. Honored to have them as a continuing show sponsor. We've got Well Foods. Check out wellfoodco.com. We have a grass-fed whey protein. There was a little some folks shot me some questions about, you know, what's the upshot of the grass-fed whey protein. Really, the upshot is the sustainability piece. So when we grass-feed cattle versus grain-feed cattle, then we've got some real nice, you know, ecological, economic kind of considerations there. As far as what is actually going in the bottle, not a whole lot of difference because hopefully you've removed most of the fats when you have concentrated your whey protein concentrates or whey protein isolates. So that's not really the issue. The issue is more the production and sustainability and all that stuff, which Well Foods carries a very nice grass-fed whey protein, also grass-fed jerky. Some cool snack foods, but we also have some kind of on-the-road meal replacement options that we're rolling out here pretty soon. So check out wellfoodco.com, frontdeskhq.com. Frontdesk HQ is not the name of the company, but it is the name of the website. These people have to make this so confusing because there's no goddamn URLs left in the world anymore because everybody's bought them up. Frontdesk is your mobile solution for running a service-based business. We've got everything from dog walking, hair salons. There's even like some food delivery stuff. It's crazy who's using Frontdesk for, you know, managing their business, front end, back end, running payroll, the whole deal. Check that out.
almost virtually guarantee that you're going to get better rates than your current credit card processor and all that jive. Like, they're very, very competitive, have some huge economies of scale already, so check those folks out. And last but not least, the performance menu. Check out the, go to performancemenu.com. Subscribe to the Performance Menu, the Journal of Nutrition and Athletic Excellence. It is the best publication in the genre on Olympic lifting, powerlifting, food, anecdotes from the gym. It is phenomenal. You've got a 30-day or a $30 per year plan, which is so cheap, it's almost ridiculous that Greg Everett is selling it for that little. And then you've got a much more reasonably priced, in my opinion, $100 plan, which gives you access to all the back issues and some other schnazzy stuff. Did I miss anything?
Yeah. I think that's it.
Cool. Cool. Awesome.
Okay. Let's see here. Let's start off with Mount Kilimanjaro altitude and GI function. Sounds like it could be dangerous.
Not at all.
Jessica says, hey guys, so you featured me as a testimonial recently. And there's a link, of course. I am doing quite well. A few minor issues still being ironed out, but it has been a full year that I have been grain, dairy, and legume free. Still climbing mountains like a madwoman and keeping my strength training on a very solid regular schedule. Feeling like $1 million. So, in this journey of making up for lost time, I had the stars aligned and I'm going to climb Kilimanjaro. I depart late June, roughly 2 months away. I know there are so many reasons for my GI to not go there, but this is something I must do for many reasons. If you want me to list them so you aren't too hard on me, I would be happy to go into the details. Haha. I'm working against many factors here, obviously. Altitude, foreign foods, you name it, and I'm sure you will. I'm looking for any advice you think would be helpful to keep me in good health on the mountain. I'll be physically on Kilimanjaro for 7 days to acclimatize. I will get a prescription from my doc for the emergency situations that could arise, Flagyl and Cipro on hand just in case. I would really prefer to use something more natural that could be preventative in hopes that I don't have to dig into those pill bottles. I'll be spending the first couple days of my trip at an orphanage in Tanzania, volunteering my time in their dental clinic for the kiddos. From there, we head to the mountain for the week. The charitable organization I'm climbing with is aware of my dietary restrictions and has gluten-free and other foods to meet my needs. I will also be shipping over plenty of safe snacks and trail foods for myself. Any suggestions you would be greatly appreciated. I promise to place an RW flag at the top of Kili for you. Jessica.
Sweet. Right on. And then we don't have to climb it, so that seems like a win-win for everybody.
Perfect.
Hopefully, the unfortunate thing is this podcast isn't going to air until after Jessica has probably already climbed Kilimanjaro. So we apologize for that, but maybe this will help other people. You know, it sounds like, honestly, you've dotted most of the I's, crossed most of the T's. I think that I've mentioned in my book this product, Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a beneficial yeast, and you might start taking some of that before the event. I think being really dosed up well on probiotics, being really well rested, you know, all of that sort of stuff is kind of the best that you're going to do. And then from there, I think that you did the due diligence of getting some Flagyl and some Cipro. And I mean, the reality is, for the most part, like, if you get something in Africa and you start having the trots or things start coming out of both ends, this isn't the time to go to, like, Whole Foods and try to get some wormwood or something like that. Like, you want to strafe bomb and destroy everything that is creeping and crawling inside your gut at that point. So, you know, just be smart about that stuff. Water contamination is a big deal. Something that folks forget about is actually hand sanitization, like your own hands and stuff like that. So, like, when you need to poo or piddle, if you've got something like some Purell bottles, which can be damnably hard to travel with because you can't pack anything sizable in your carry-on, so you throw it in the underbelly of the plane, and unless it's properly packed, then the stuff outgasses and ends up all over the place instead of staying in the bottle. So TSA and all those monkeys make that stuff kind of challenging, but definitely maintaining good, just standard hygiene while you're climbing. I used to do a fair amount of backpacking, and it's a challenge. And anything from Giardia to biting insects that carry disease are potentialities there. So beyond that, it sounds like you've done most of the
the legwork on this, and you've got some gluten-free options, probably going to be some corn and stuff like that. But I think that in that neck of the woods, it's probably going to be pretty mellow. So it definitely will be very interested to hear what your experience was. That would be cool as a follow-up to see what you actually did do and what the, you know, what the results were.
Sweet. Okay. Caveman Bunions. Rich says, hi, I'm 1 year into my caveman metamorphosis, but following 40 years of being a zoo human and some time in the infantry, I have two rather unsightly bunions. They only hurt mildly some of the time, but they do restrict what boots I can wear without exacerbating the problem. I'm thinking of bunion surgery, but I was wondering, before I go down that road, whether there are any paleo-esque interventions or alternatives. And what do you think about bunion surgery? Thank you in anticipation of your answer.
Oh, man, I have no personal experience with bunions, so I can't really think of any, you know, body. I don't know if you can get in and do, like, super gnarly ART body work and, like, break them up. It sounds like it seems like it would be absolutely horrible. So did Greg, any experience with bunions?
I don't have any experience with bunions, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the cost benefit on this stuff is whenever you undergo some sort of surgery, there's always the potential for problems, you know, I mean, just, you know, secondary infections and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, there's always the potential that, you know, you end up with some scar tissue or some, you know, some type of issues that, you know, kind of unforeseen problems that could end up being worse than what you have right now. But I would probably just get a couple of different recommendations from podiatrists and see what these folks are thinking. You know, what are the potential, what's like the worst case scenario that could come out of this, and then what's kind of the best case upshot. And that's how I would probably do some sort of a risk assessment on that. And I guess that would apply to anything from, you know, bunion surgery to like a MCL repair or, you know, anything like that. You know, try to find the best doc, get some second opinions, do some risk analysis, and then that's kind of your best bet. You know, clearly we try to focus on low intervention things, but some minor surgery here and there can be absolutely the bee's knees for the right situation, but it can also kill or maim if it's not the right situation. So I guess that's all the, you know, the basic risk assessment stuff I could do, since I can't even, I don't even think my broken down unhealthy parents had any bunions. My dad had bad feet, but and I have like zero arches. I haven't had arches even when I was a kid, so I don't know, but that's what, yeah, I got, man.
It seems like it's relatively minor, and if he's a otherwise healthy adult, then most likely a minor surgery shouldn't be too big of a deal. But if you're, you know, 80 years old and in poor health, and your surgery is going to take place in some dirt-floored hospital in, you know, some third-world country, then I would probably look for alternatives in that case. But
oh, and Greg, that's developing countries now. That's developing countries.
Sorry.
Yeah, because if we say third world country, then the people in those countries listening to this first world podcast are going to feel set upon by us.
Oh, I apologize.
Yeah.
What happened? Where are the second world countries?
I think that's everybody who used to be like pretty hoity-toity, like Spain, Portugal, Italy, anything that's been a world power, has indoor plumbing and electricity, former empires, but now not so much. And so, yeah. I think that's how it all breaks down. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm not well versed in the ranking of former empires and up and comers and what have you.
And hip hip and whatnot. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about L-tyrosine instead of this. David says, hi, Rob. Longtime listener here. Thanks for all the information. You've helped change my life. Recently had an organic acids test done, and the results indicated that I should supplement with L-tyrosine. Thought, what the hell, and picked up some 500 milligram capsules. Wow and wow. Instant energy picked me up from one capsule in the morning that lasts most of the day. This boost feels, quote, natural and not like the buzz that borders on nausea on the odd occasion I drink coffee. I get that L-tyrosine is used in the synthesis of dopamine and that this might explain my better energy levels, but I also understand that this amino acid is commonly found in food. My question, why is supplementing a small dose of L-tyrosine so helpful when I eat lots of protein? Should I also supplement 5-HTP or any other amino acid to balance my neurotransmitters, as some people recommend online? I used to have microscopic colitis, but I thought I had fully recovered. Perhaps this experience suggests otherwise. Any thoughts would be appreciated. I need to get my glasses prescription updated. I cannot read to save my life.
I just blow up my my screen so that, like, if Nikki walks in, she's like, are you trying to barbecue a chicken with that? Like, I just blow everything up enormous to make it easy on my eyes. But, you know, the amino acids for neurotransmitters, like, these things can be very, very powerful, very nice targeted therapeutics. But there's a huge individual kind of consideration within all this stuff. It's kind of cool that you've nailed this one down, and it seems pretty pretty solid supplementing with the tyrosine. And yeah, it's definitely a dopamine precursor. The reason why you probably are getting a bump on this is you need to remember that in food we have a mix of all the 21 typically amino acids or thereabout, depending on the type of food that we are taking in, and all of these things have a tendency for competing both with crossing the digestive border and then crossing the blood-brain border. And, if we're taking, say, like tryptophan to convert into serotonin and melatonin and help with sleep, then we really like that to be kind of a singular standalone item so that we don't have competition going on. And I suspect that that's probably a similar story here. The question about should you take other things to help balance stuff out, it's a really good one. There's a guy, Dr. Dan Kalish, Eva T does some work with him. So you could track down Eva's website and maybe do some consulting with her, or track down Dr. Kalish and do some work with him. And, you know, there's some argument that singular doses, large doses of a neurotransmitter amino acids could over time cause some burnout, and that actually that may be part of the problem that we see in general. You know, like people eat a refined carbohydrate centric diet, which ends up being a little bit tryptophan and serotonin dominant, and then we get some issues with cortisol because of blood sugar swings, and that can exacerbate this kind of tryptophan serotonin kind of story. But over the long haul, what ends up happening, interestingly, is we end up kind of dopamine deficient in this whole process, and this kind of wacky non-linearity kind of story. And so different people make some arguments about balancing this stuff out. I've got to say, the nuts and bolts of how to do it, completely outside my wheelhouse. Like, I have zero experience with the therapeutic interventions, running the blood work, doing all that stuff. Totally out of my wheelhouse. You'd have to check some other people out with that. I understand the theory, the concept. Haven't played with that with clients or on myself. But some people do. Some people claim some really, really significant therapeutic benefits out of this stuff. So I think it's worth checking out, and everything you described here kind of makes sense. I really doubt that the colitis would be an issue specifically with a tyrosine absorption. It could be, but I think most, how do I want to say this? I know for myself, I tend to be a little dopamine deficient relative to where I would like to be. I think that's why I've tended towards stimulants and loud music, headbutting bars while powerlifting and generally doing goofy stuff like that. And over time, though, interestingly, like I've figured out that some more mellow activity actually kind of builds the dopamine reserve in a more sustainable long-term level versus that binge and purge dose gone down regulation kind of thing like I've done in my youth. So that's what I got on that.
Yeah, but that's no fun.
That isn't any fun, and it really doesn't make for good books or TV shows. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do it for us, Rob.
Yeah, the quiet meditating rock star isn't nearly as interesting as the one that does a ton of blow and almost dies multiple times and then passes out in a bathtub and drowns at the age of like 28 or something. So that's a good story. People cry over that shit and build you know, monuments and stuff. So
exactly. Yeah. You got to think long term.
Yeah.
You got to think about your future.
Yeah.
What legacy are you going to leave?
Yeah, you're just going to grow old and die after you've used up all your creativity, or, you know, go out in a blaze of glory and, you know, people can you know, worship you from centuries in the future.
Yes. All right. This one is called Need Gummy Bears and Snickers. Is L-glutamine okay? Help. can't wait to see how these things tie together.
I'm predicting Olivia a train wreck. I'm predicting a train wreck, but we'll see.
Yeah, I think, I'm going to withhold judgment for now because it's not a positive one. Olivia says, hi, guys. I'm a 41-year-old female, 5'5", 130 pounds, would like to lose 5 pounds, and mostly want to stop my cravings for sugar, mostly paleo diet, 80% for the last few months, snacks of corn chips and corn tortillas a few times a week. Wine 2 glasses per month max. 100% gluten-free as I'm gluten intolerant, probably celiac. I didn't have the intestinal biopsy. My question, is a short-term 3-month round of L-glutamine okay to help with the intense sugar cravings that I experience? On average, I take 3 grams a day, 3,000 milligram pills. Some days are 2 grams. In addition, I'm taking chromium and also magnesium. The combination in these three things is really helping me stay away from the Snickers. I've heard that after years of gut permeability that L-glutamine may help to repair my gut. After a few months, I can wean off of it and may not need it. I understand that L-glutamine is given to patients who have intestinal problems after celiac diagnosis, as well as cancer patients undergoing chemo. I'm assuming this is not the worst thing that I could be taking, but I would love to hear your fancy medical explanation as to what this is doing to my body. When I take 3 grams a day, I'm able to eat a very healthy diet with little to no cravings for sugar. As a side note, I have craved sugar since I was 10 years old, and from what I can remember, I have been gluten intolerant from that age as well. If I could just eat chocolate and Trix cereal all day, I would. But I would. I guess I just hope you'll tell me that it's healthier to take 3 grams of L-glutamine than to eat the equivalent of 1 to 2 full-size candy bars every day instead of sugar and chocolate. And again, I'm just doing 3 months, and then I will go off and hope I can do without. Thanks, guys. I guess I'm kind of confused by this one. Like, did someone tell her that glutamine was, like, horribly unhealthy for her or something?
Yeah, I'm wondering about that. Like, I see no problem taking glutamine over the long haul.
I take
haul.
Freaking 10 grams a day.
Yeah, yeah. So, I, you know, there are some folks, like, there are some folks that talk about glutamine, glutamate, you know, like the monosodium glutamate stuff and neurotoxicity. I've never
you mean the
really,
stuff that makes Chinese food taste delicious?
Yeah, like I've never really been able to wrap my head around that. Like I'm not in the glutamate hypothesis camp. I know some people are, and God, this is probably going to open up some other can of gnashing of teeth and contention over a point of minutia that is not even. It's like as important as. Should I wipe my ass 2 times today or 3? And it's kind of like, well, how messy was it? And it's like, it was pretty messy. Well, then wipe it 3 times. And you know, it's like, I tinker with it, don't tinker with it. I don't know, but I definitely don't know why Olivia is concerned about the glutamine. Like, that seems entirely fine. And I'm going to make a bet that if somebody performed a home invasion with a chocolate-sniffing hound dog, that Olivia has this shit in her house. So Olivia, I'm gonna hold your feet to the fire here a little bit, and you know the best self defense don't be there, you know. And this is why in my book I recommend that people clean out their pantry, bag up all their shitty food, take it to the Jesus Center, accelerate the death of the homeless, all that sort of stuff, because we're not wired up for self control. So we just plan for that. You plan for. Assuming you don't have self-control, which is kind of ironic that I would end up at the Bunny Ranch at all. But, you know, I told my wife and et cetera, and, you know, because I usually have some hookers and cocaine kind of analogies built into all that stuff. But, you know, this is, I'm not even going to go down. I was going to talk about why I never went out drinking when I worked on the level one CrossFit cert teams and stuff like that. But I'll just
anyone
I'll just
who's
leave
been
that
involved
as an
knows
aside.
Exactly why.
Yeah, that's why I'm still married. So anyway, yeah.
So I'm going to say that you're probably a little bit of a cookie monster and you're storing that stuff at home. And so you need to bag, you know, can that. And if this is bad enough that like you're jumping in the car and going down to 7-Eleven and buying a Snickers, then I don't know, maybe we need to put a low jack on you or something so that when you go get near, you know, cacao proximity, this thing starts shocking you like a, you know, pit bull shock collar style or something. I don't know, but the glutamine should not be a problem. If it's helping you, that's great, but I also have a feeling that you've got a stash of this stuff at home. And, you know, I'm no saint. If we have shitty food at home, I eat it. I just don't buy shitty food. Like if I'm gonna, typically if I'm gonna eat something that is kind of off rails, I'll go out and I'll get something. Like I'll get a dessert, or we'll go get some gluten-free pizza, or I'll find some place that makes some really righteous nachos and I'll have some nachos and then I'm done. But if the stuff's at home, I'll just snack on it. And like Nikki will consume the whole thing in like an hour. And so I just don't have the stuff at home, which I think is part of the problem here. I'd be willing to bet some grass-fed jerky Well Foods. So yeah,
sweet.
Craig's like awesome.
Yeah. Well, no, I agree completely. If it's not in the house, I won't eat it. And if it is, then I will annihilate it. Because why not? It's there.
Exactly.
All right. Okay, this next one is called Am I Killing My Boyfriend? Sounds scary. Catherine, Rob. Sorry. Catherine says, Rob, as I know, you can understand affection towards feline critters, and my condolences to you regarding the late Keystone. I thought I might ask about my own. My boyfriend has asthma and cat allergies. Not a great combination when he and I both love cats. I purchased 2 Siberian kittens this spring because I did some research and found that they can be hypoallergenic for some people because they're supposed to lack the enzyme in their saliva that we react to when their dandruff flakes off. Sadly, despite my best efforts, my boyfriend is reacting to them. I've heard that owners can become more accustomed to their cats over time, but whether or not this happens, I'm wondering how bad this is for his health. Am I taking years off my boyfriend's life due to the chronic inflammation of his asthma? I feel shitty about this, but love my cats. We're paleo, and I try to implement cod liver oil, bone broth, probiotics, and anti-inflammatory diet to try to reduce his asthma, although he still parties like a hero, so my efforts are thwarted to some extent. We haven't had much success reducing his asthma at this point. Do I need to drown my cats? Just kidding. One more question. I'd love to feed my cats a raw paleo diet, ground meats, bones, liver, the whole spiel, but we travel a lot and kibble is so stupidly convenient. Did you feed Keystone a raw diet? Is buying grain-free kibble and gluten-free canned meat pate any better? They often put sweet potato and other fruits and veggies in the food, likely to add micronutrient content, but I know cats are obligate carnivores, so I'm not sure how this fares on their digestive tract. Your work is immeasurable. Thank you. And Greg's voice is super sexy, FYI.
Indeed.
She didn't actually write that. I just put that in.
She did write it. We have proof. It's right there. Either that or Squatchy added it in later for some dramatic effect.
Hey, I've always said I've got a face made for radio.
Yes. That's a good line. Is she killing her boyfriend? So one, you know, usually we do.
Is she killing her boyfriend?
See some improvement in asthma and allergies when folks are eating paleo. If Brother Man is partying like a rock star, then I mean it really doesn't take much to completely undo that. So I guess to some degree, you know, that just is what it is. It's an interesting thing, the inflammatory process and immune activity. People who have some mild allergies tend to have a little bit of a protection against a variety of cancers because the immune system is kind of ramped up and stuff like that. But then people who have allergies also are a little bit more predisposed towards cardiovascular complications. So all of this stuff is kind of a trade-off. Like you want the right amount of immune response, not too much, not too little. Getting a cold every once in a while is actually good from like a cancer prevention standpoint. Being chronically sick and inflamed is bad from both a cancer and an autoimmunity standpoint. So, you know, there's trade-offs and dose response curves and all this stuff to kind of consider. So I'm not sure what to say beyond that. There are some desensitization techniques. So you can go to an allergist, and I think that they can help you get over your cat dander allergies with some, I think they do some under the skin shots and stuff like that. Clearly tightening up the diet, making sure you avoid gluten, all that stuff. You know, if the partying is NorCal margaritas and raw meat, then we shouldn't have too much of a problem. If it's Sierra Nevada wheat ale and submarine sandwiches, then we're kind of right back to square one. So I guess that's that. And then, you know, Keystone, Nikki had been feeding Keystone a pretty, in my opinion, piss poor diet until I came on the scene. And then we did a little bit of raw, we did a little bit of canned, and then for a kibble, there's this stuff called Evo by Anova, which seemed pretty solid. All of the completely lunatic fringe cat people, when I mentioned previously that we were feeding him Evo, told me that Evo had been purchased by Purina and so now was no longer as good. We never noticed a difference with Keystone's health or his affinity towards the food one way or the other. So I don't know if that's, you know, a tinfoil hat deal or what, but the Evo seemed legit. I think just kind of mixing it up. He definitely liked canned sardines, which are convenient, and you know, we'd bust him out a can or two of those a week and good omega-3s, and he definitely liked all that stuff. And ironically, this is like I think about the day we're recording this, maybe 1 year and a day to the day that little guy got nabbed by a coyote. So still bummed, still a bummer.
Yeah, I remember that funny little guy.
He's a good little bugger.
Okay, let's see here. Corey says, "Hi guys, my husband and I went paleo about a year and a half ago and love it. We've each lost about 35 pounds. The other day, though, something very scary happened. My husband suddenly broke out in hives, and within several minutes, his entire body was covered. He looked like he'd been attacked by a swarm of bees. About 30 minutes earlier, he'd eaten a bunch of shrimp for dinner. I hung up with my husband and called my uncle, an intelligent biochemist who'd developed a shrimp allergy a few years back. He said, well, for one, he's lucky to be alive, and then went on to explain what was going on in my husband's body. Both my husband and I then began Googling away, and after following a trail that led me to Lauren Cordain's website, here's what I concluded. Please let me know if I'm kinda sorta right. My husband, who had eaten shrimp with no reaction as recently as 1 week earlier, and who'd eaten the same meal about a month earlier, had, quote, kicked up his heels a bit in the 36 hours prior to this shrimp meal. He'd had a night of drinking followed by a day with two gluten-containing meals. Could this have left his gut punched full of holes, which then allowed that lectin-y shrimp to seep in and cause the reaction? I listened to the podcast and remember you mentioning leaky gut being the culprit for an allergy to all sorts of normally benign foods. And also hearing of people whose appendix had burst after going out for a huge pasta dinner. Also, along with the shrimp, he consumed raw broccoli and ranch dressing, and the sauce on his shrimp was garlic, butter, Worcestershire, and Tabasco. Since shrimp is on the list of the 10 most allergenic foods, we concluded it was the shrimp. He's going in next week to be tested for a shrimp allergy. What happened? Could he have just as easily had the same reaction if he'd gone to town on some peanuts? Should a general warning be issued to the paleo people to proceed with caution when eating these foods if their gut has recently been compromised? Regarding anaphylactic shock, my husband said, it's ironic that in an effort to save itself when exposed to a threat, the body could take it too far and kill itself. I responded with this theory. Well, maybe it's like the runner's high predator attack lights out thing, where the body says, yeah, this is going to be really painful, and in the end, you're going to die, so we're going to ease your suffering. Only with anaphylactic shock, your body just goes ahead and completely relieves you from experiencing a long, slow, painful death. What do you think of that? Thank you in advance for tackling this. I don't think death by suffocation is that pleasant and quick.
Yeah. And I'm a big subscriber to evolutionary theory and whatnot, but I don't know that there's a... I don't really understand the mechanism of a peaceful outing really having any type of selective advantage, but who knows?
I think people just need to accept the possibility that your body may make a mistake every once in a while.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot of moving parts there. I think that you're probably on point with this stuff. Like I've actually been doing some research on allergies related to exactly this and kind of tracking it back into some grain consumption and also some different pharmaceuticals that cause some gut permeability. Unfortunately, alcohol can contribute to gut permeability. So
You know, this is, God, I don't know what to say with this. And this is part of my deal, you know, maybe an extension from the cheat meal freak out that I had a couple of podcasts back. Like, this is why, you know, out of anything that we've got out there to avoid, just fucking avoid gluten. Like, is it that goddamn hard to do at this point? Like, there's just so, like, if you really are just Wolverine and you don't react to it, then fine. But then every once in a while we get something like this, or we get, you know, the person who's like, yeah, I had this, you know, I was eating pretty clean, and then I had a gluten dose, and then I had appendicitis, and you know, the reality is your gut heals, you get some sort of an exposure that is irritating, and then you get a potentially potent response, and it just seems kind of borderline retarded to play with this stuff at this point. But again, like, people do whatever you want to do. Like, I don't really have any dog in the fight, particularly if you do this stuff and you may, you know, in your living trust. You know, here's the deal. Here's the deal. If you want to eat some gluten, here's the deal. Just put me into your living trust for like 10% of whatever you own. And then I'm cool with it. Just go to town. Like, I don't give a shit then. Like, kick your heels up. Go wild. Then Greg and I can split the proceeds on that, and we'll figure out some smarter use for your money after you're dead, and we're cool. So have reckless abandon on your cheat meals. Just pencil us in for 10% of your assets. We're not asking for much. That's about what most churches ask for, is 10%. So we're good. Go. What else?
Gluten, yeah, tithing. Shit.
I think this is all pretty on point, honestly. I mean, as far as causing some gut permeability, and then the potential for intact food particles to make their way into the system. And, you know, the deal with allergies is that they can accrue slowly over time. They could happen, you know, you're going to get one freebie exposure, which then you get, the body is mounting an immune response and creating antibodies and priming itself for the next exposure. You're going to get a big histamine dump and bronchoconstriction, vasodilation, hypovolemic shock, and potentially death. So, you know, just because you had one meal as a freebie, that it, there's a huge spectrum on this. And you know, even within all this stuff, you know, we could have somebody who maybe is kind of hypochloritic, some low stomach acid, they're in a hurry, they otherwise eat paleo, but they're not, you know, digesting their food the way that they should because they're kind of a busy person, not chewing up their food, low stomach acid due to stress. And that could be a mechanism for this stuff too. So there's a lot of different ways for this to happen, but that gluten-y cheat meal just seems to be a good way for causing some problems. So for the love of God, have some corn tortillas and a NorCal margarita. Like, I just don't, at this point, I just don't get it. But people keep doing it. And we asked earlier if people felt like the podcast was still valuable, and people said it was. So I guess I'll continue to be flummoxed that people do stupid shit like this. But again, when you do this stupid shit, just make sure to pencil us in for 10% of your assets and we're good. All is forgiven 20. Then. Yeah.
All right. Hierarchy of meat. Beth says, I've listened to and loved every one of your podcasts and always feel that I learned something new. See? Here's a question that my husband came up with, and I thought we should ask Rob. If you had to list meats in order of how nutritious and desirable they are, in spite of how bastardized they have become from modern agricultural practices, how would it go? Some examples would be pastured chicken, grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, pastured pork, CAFO beef, poultry house chicken, standard pork, and farmed fish. And I'm going to skip that middle part because she says I can. Hope this makes sense, and thank you for your podcast.
Man, so I guess at the top of the list would be
bacon.
Bacon, clearly. And then this is kind of like the Mohs hardness scale, you know, where diamond is a 10, but really it should be like a 30. you know, and there's like this exponential, you know, growth curve on the whole thing. Logarithmic scale really doesn't scale accurately with bacon, you know, just out there by a mile. But after that, I think any type of wild caught seafood, wild game is at the top of the list just because of, you know, and if we are assuming that the wild caught seafood has some sustainability kind of considerations involved, and, you know, the wild game has some, you know, should have some sustainability considerations because of, you know, hunting seasons and all that sort of jive. But from a nutrition standpoint, from a sustainability standpoint, I think you put the wild caught seafood, wild game right at the top. And I don't know that I would order one above the other. Both are fantastic. Ideally, you're mixing and matching with that stuff. And then after that, I would put grass-fed beef, the pastured chicken, depending on what type of story we're playing out there, like whether or not it's still getting a ton of grains or it's legitimately like just pretty much a pastured chicken. Like when I did a talk for CrossFit Carson Valley recently, I got a ton of swag from that because usually I just ask for a bottle of booze and a hunk of meat to do these local talks, and these guys went above and beyond. Like it was pretty incredible, and so they actually had a legitimate pastured chicken from these folks. They don't feed them any grains. They just dig around out in the horse and pork pastures and do their magic out there. And the chicken was absolutely amazing. And it was interesting. It was a decent sized chicken, but it wasn't huge. But one interesting thing is that I did save the carcass, boiled it down, you know, did the bone broth because I could just, you know, ladle myself with bone broth because that stuff is so amazing, and, you know, rub it into my pores and everything. But I did notice that the bones from this legitimately pastured chicken, they didn't break down at all the way that, you know, even a Whole Foods or a Trader Joe's like organic pastured chicken does. Like the bones on this this wild bird or wilder bird were pretty impressive. You know, from there, I think your you know, feedlot beef, farm fish end up being virtually identical. There was just a study that came out that said that farmed salmon, because of the high soybean oil content of the farmed salmon from feeding clearly the salmon soybean products, was actually problematic for insulin sensitivity in children. That's what they said. I didn't read the whole. I scanned the abstract because I've been busy as hell, but it was kind of interesting. So this is another thing where if you've got the money to get some wild caught fish and some grass fed meat and all that, I think it's good both from the sustainability standpoint, but also the food quality standpoint. So I guess that's how I would largely order this stuff out.
Cool. Okie dokie. High rep. Well, this says high rep hypertrophy, but all night boozing. I was saying hypertrophy.
I believe that's the intention. Maybe they were still drunk when they wrote this.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure this is English.
It's ESL plus alcohol.
Yeah, yeah.
Just forgive me in advance. Frederick says, "Hey, you guys are the best infotainment on the web, etc." Two questions: Duet to a congenital arterial malformation, coarctation of the aorta. My aorta is narrower than it should be. I have two stents in place, widening it somewhat. My doctors recommend that I don't do any strength training that puts too much pressure on the artery at any one time. In more detail, they don't want me to do any exercises where a Valsalva is required or where I can't do at least 15 reps. So my question is, should I give up on any dreams of hypertrophy, or can a reasonable amount of hypertrophy be achieved with a 15 to 20 rep program? If yes, how would you construct such a program? Any differences in other programs? I'm thinking maybe some sort of HIIT styles. Circuit training. I like that. Circle training. Additional background info. I am somewhat trained with a PR of 14 chin-ups and parallel bar dips, but a fairly small guy, 68 kilos. I have a visible 4-pack. When I wake up in the morning or later, I don't know where I am. Have been drinking and dancing all night and have only 1 hour of sleep under my belt in some random girl's bed. How do I best recover with a time machine? Should I try to sleep as much as possible, as quickly as possible? Or should I use power naps and other techniques to try to reset circadian rhythm as quickly as possible? Some Goldilocks zone? Also, how do I prevent damage as much as possible? You don't do it in the first place.
Wear rubber.
Yeah, seriously. Bonus question. It's your lucky day. How long should I wait before writing a girl from the night before if I want to see her again? Does it depend on whether we just met and talked or ended up leaving together? Thanks for everything you do. You guys are awesome.
That'll definitely be the juicy part of this thing. Okay, let's go through the bullshit so that we can get down to the dating part. I think you could probably build a decent amount of mass doing a you know, kind of the 15 to 20 rep range. I think that, you know, the Valsalva stuff would be way more concerning with lower body movements where you know, a squat or a deadlift where you really have a significant amount of weight. But I could see chinning, dipping. Those things seem like you wouldn't get nearly as powerful of a kind of a aortic distension or, you know, I don't think it would be as concerning from that Valsalva maneuver standpoint. And if you bounce that off of a good cardiac rehab person, or a couple of them to get a little bit of a statistical average on that, I think that would work. So, like, I would be way more concerned about that stuff with the lower body work, heavier weights, lower body. But I don't know that circuit training is the way that I would go at all. I mean, you're already doing high reps, so then it just starts looking like step aerobics. So, stay within the guidelines your doc gave you. But, it doesn't look all that far afield from a standard bodybuilding deal, other than you will see bodybuilders get down in the sixes and eights reasonably frequently, at least some of the time. So, Greg, any other thoughts on that chunk of the story?
Yeah, exactly what I was going to say is that's going to be pretty standard bodybuilding fare. So I would just do a little poking around at some popular bodybuilding kind of programs and go from there. Avoid the super high blood pressure, high heart rate, which probably means no circuit training.
I think the heart rate is okay. It seems like the concern is that vascular loading from a Valsalva, full body contraction kind of gig.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Then that should be fairly easy if you're not. I mean, I would say probably the two big ones are squats and deadlifts, like you kind of alluded to. And because 15 rep squats, you could still load pretty heavy to the point where you'd be pressurizing really hard each rep. So that might not be a great idea. I mean, you might, God forbid, I say this out loud, but you might have to keep it light or even do like leg press sort of stuff where it's just less loading on the trunk.
Right.
So, okay. Do you have dating advice for him?
Yeah, well, we had the recovery from all night, being out all night and shaking his groove thing. And dude, you just gotta, you're young, just suck it up and deal with it. I mean, the standard deal is sleep as much as you can. That's just the standard deal. So if that means taking some power naps, definitely getting back on your normal cycle is very good. Like, you don't want to goof things up such that you find it hard to go to bed. I believe, like, 15-minute blocks, 15 to 90-minute blocks seem to be the most therapeutic with regards to, like, reestablishing neurotransmitters. Next time we get Doc Parsley on here, I'll have him go over all that stuff. I haven't committed all that to memory, but there's different things. Like, if you need a creativity boost, a 15-minute nap is good. If you need a memory enhancement boost, then, like, 45 minutes is good. And this is based off of what level of sleep that you're going to be getting into. And so, basically sliding into REM sleep will help with creativity, doesn't help a ton with memory encoding and stuff like that. So there are some strategies on that, but I wouldn't worry too much. And then, so if I really liked a girl, I usually pinged her fairly quickly. You know, I didn't let a ton of grass grow under my feet. I think that Greg's a little more sly of a devil and probably let them wonder a little bit more. But if I really dug her, I didn't let her wonder too long. What do you think, Greg?
I never had a strategy. I never had a game plan. Mm. I just was myself.
Well,
because
yeah.
You know what? Yeah. If she doesn't like you, then fuck her anyway. Especially yeah. if you already did. So
okay, moving on to number nine.
But in all seriousness, don't
overthink
it. It's amazing
that you and I actually got married into reasonably decent females. So, yeah.
Yes, love you.
Yeah, love you.
Yeah, I just do what you want to do.
That is totally true. That is totally true because I mean, it. Here's the deal: if the girl is neurotic, then no matter what you do, she's going to make you wrong for it.
Yeah.
So you can call quickly, and then it's gonna be like, well, he's too aggressive, or you know, like he's too into me. I want a little bit more of a challenge, and you don't want to fuck around with that. Like that's a nightmare. Yeah. And I'll actually throw my wife under the bus a little bit. There was about a 6-month period of her rolling in and rolling out like the ocean, and then finally, what kind of broke the whole thing. I was like, you know what? You can bounce, kid. Like, I'm over this. Like, I totally dig you. You're super cool, but you can beat it. And I actually thought she was great, and she was, you know, she was in this hemming and hawing kind of deal, and I was totally over it, and actually cut her off pretty good for about, I don't know, 3 weeks. Wouldn't really reply to phone calls. Was cool. Cordial but cool at Capoeira when I would see her, and she finally she made the final pitch and was like, hey, do you want to get together and do some dinner, blah blah blah, and then we basically barely spent a day apart since that fateful day. But you know, it was kind of yeah. But I've got to say, like, I didn't feel like I was doing anything weird or untoward or anything, and she was finding fault with everything I did. And I finally was like, fuck this, man. She was
just scared of the intensity of her feelings for you, Rob.
Which is indeed what it ended up being. But at the same time, like you can't be both boyfriend and therapist. You just can't do it. And if you do try to do it, it's going to be a mess. So like that's where you really, really dig the person. But depending on the baggage or the situation, you may just have to cut that whole thing loose, and it'll be better for all concerned, or at least some other poor schmuck will get to deal with the chick drinking herself into a blackout and punching holes in the walls like my old girlfriend used to do. So,
yeah, I figure if you've got to go that far out of your way to play this game before you guys are even together, it's not going to get any better once you are together. You're going to be getting... I don't know how to put that diplomatically, but you're not going to have a good time long term.
And if you're at any university anywhere, then it's more females than males, and so you don't need to work.
Yeah,
just don't be a dick. Probability. And you'll be fine. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, if you're not a dick, eventually you will attract good women.
Somebody.
I mean, yeah. If you are a dick, you'll attract more women overall, most likely, but they'll be awful. So.
And you just don't want them to know each other, because then they'll compare notes, and then you're going to have to completely change majors, shift into a completely different section of the university, because all these gals are going to compare notes on you and like henpeck you to death. And the next person that I was going to say victim or prospective date, they're going to go Warner, and you'll be done. So then you'll just have to shift from like microbiology to biochemistry or you know, something like that. So
something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess we should move on to squats.
Yeah.
Well, more specifically, why Brian's squats suck. Brian says, Jumbo, I was hoping you could possibly offer some ideas for why my squat numbers have always sucked, be it a powerlifting style squat or Olympic style. I've almost given up on them ever being respectable, such as double body weight, but I feel like my body deserves an explanation at the very least. I used to follow a West Side template with my training. Louis Simmons has on more than one occasion revealed that his lifters never do back squats in training like they would in competition. Instead, they do various forms of box squats and then are always able to squat more in competition without the box. In theory, this makes sense to me since a box squat, in a box squat, the hamstrings and glutes are really being emphasized and pausing on the box removes some of the stored energy you would use in a conventional powerlifting squat. However, I've never come within 70 pounds of my 425 box squat and can't figure out why. Fast forward to the past 8 months since I've switched to an Olympic-style squat to focus on more carryover to the clean and snatch. I spent several months just working on the technique outlined in both of your lifting books. I then tested out at a humble 140 kilos before embarking on a 12-week structured program mimicking the template outlined in the Olympic Weightlifting for Sports book. At the 6-week mark, I tested out again at 140, then 142.5 at the 12-week mark. I obviously don't blame the programmed. It just seems like with good technique, which several coaches have confirmed I have, and consistently following any type of structured program, I'd make more than a 2.5 kilo jump after 12 weeks, especially with such a low starting point. I've heard you talk about body proportions before and how that could be a limiting factor. How do you measure that? I've never walked down the street and felt like my femurs were particularly long, but I'm willing to look into it and provide some answers. Here are my other numbers. 5'11", 192, 11% body fat, deadlift 435, power clean 122.5, power snatch 87.5. Yeah, you definitely should have gotten more than 2.5 kilos out of that program. So it makes me kind of wonder how the rest of the program worked for you. And based on that, kind of what else was going on? Because without knowing that stuff, you know, I don't know. It could have been too little work for you. It could have been too much work for you. There's a million possibilities. So I don't think it has anything to do with your body structure, because whatever your structure is, that's more going to limit, you know, long-term what your max potential squat is more than what your kind of rate of development is, if that makes sense. Rob, what do you think about all that?
Yeah, and you know, you start thinking about although his other numbers aren't terrible, so I don't know. You know, one thing, like, you know, clearly the West Side stuff, just as an aside, the West Side stuff is solid for the type of geared powerlifting that they do, but you know, there's actually been a little bit of a reality check, a little bit of a resurgence into, you know, if you're not doing geared lifting, then, you know, doing something that looks more like an Ollie style squat in the off season, widening the squat out and dropping the bar down your delts a little bit for a meet to just break parallel for a powerlifting meet. Like, folks are discovering that in fact works and works rather well. There's been kind of a resurgence in the raw powerlifting scene, and that, you know, quad development is actually a good thing, both from an injury prevention standpoint and from a actual you know, numbers on the bar standpoint. And so that's just a thought. You know, it would be interesting to see some video, see a little anthropometry on this guy squatting. But you know, you make a really good point too, that we should have just seen some increase here. And so it would be, you know, if you did like a deadlift cycle or something, are we seeing way, way better improvement there? Or are we just not seeing any improvement anywhere? Which then makes me start thinking about like dose response curves, hormone status, nutritional status, sleep quality, you know, all that sort of stuff. Because we unless we've got a really advanced lifter, like you've been lifting a long, long time, like five plus years, so what, a reasonably advanced training age, but you just may not be that fast twitch or have that much genetic potential on that stuff, then, you know, we should see more. We should see something else happening.
Yeah, I'm not satisfied with that progress. So you got to take a look and figure out what's going on. And, you know, the other thing too, I mean, one possibility that comes to mind too is that I think especially with squats, people are – kind of weird about testing them. I've seen a lot of people post videos of one rep max squats and things like that. That, I mean, visually, I can guarantee that's not a max effort. You know what I mean? So it may be that you're a bit squeamish about kind of pushing the squat, and there was maybe a little more in the tank that you couldn't quite tap. You know, it's really hard to say without knowing more than what you had in that question.
But hopefully you've found our ubiquitous commentary helpful.
I'm trying to be as ambiguous and unhelpful as possible.
Perfect.
I feel like I was successful.
Yeah. So, dude, anything else that folks need to know that they won't survive without understanding?
I don't think so. CatalystAthletics.com/cert. Take a look at that. PerformanceMenu.com. Take a look at that.
Oh, we have a new eating out guide at robwolf.com, which I think I've forgotten to mention a couple of times. And Amber basically threatened to bludgeon me with like a dump truck or something if I forgot.
That's right.
So
she asked me to remind you to do it too, and I completely forgot. Okay, so sorry, Amber.
Each of us under one tire of the dump truck. So the eating out guide, you know what? I'll throw a link to that in this particular show. I'll squat you do that. But basically, we had a lot of people asking about, you know, how do I eat out? How do I both remain paleo, but probably even more important than that, navigate the gluten-free thing? And so this eating out guide covers all that. We actually have some little printable information placards that you can take to your restaurateur that will help those folks hopefully create a gluten-free environment, or you know, like it's very similar to creating the hygienic kind of flow that you would have with a making sure that you don't get foodborne illnesses from meat and shellfish and stuff like that. So it's real obvious stuff, but you know, it's only obvious after you've seen it oftentimes. But really all kinds of goodies in there. I think the thing is like $4 or something. So pretty cheap, pretty solid. The feedback has generally been very, very good on that. So check it out.
Cool.
Sweet. All right, man. Well, thank you again. I think the podcast after this, we're going to try to have Nate Miyake on. We'll see if my internet holds on that. So we'll give it a shot.
Cool.
Awesome, dude. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. See you.
Okay. Later, man.